Scholastic Audiobooks presents Catching Fire by Suzanne Collins, read by Carolyn McCormick. Part 1. The Spark. Chapter 1. I clasp the flask between my hands, even though the warmth from the tea has long since leached into the frozen air. My muscles are clenched tight against the cold. If a pack of wild dogs were to appear at this moment, the odds of scaling a tree before they attacked are not in my favor. I should get up, move around, and work the stiffness from my limbs. But instead, I sit, as motionless as the rock beneath me, while the dawn begins to lighten the woods. I can't fight the sun. I can only watch helplessly as it drags me into a day that I've been dreading for months. By noon, they will all be at my new house in the Victor's village. The reporters, the camera crews, even Effie Trinket, my old escort, will have made their way to District 12 from the capital. I wonder if Effie will still be wearing that silly pink wig, or if she'll be sporting some other unnatural color, especially for the victory tour. There will be others waiting, too. A staff to cater to my every need on the long train trip. A prep team to beautify me for public appearances. My stylist and friend, Cinna, who designed the gorgeous outfits that first made the audience take notice of me in the Hunger Games. If it were up to me, I would try to forget the Hunger Games entirely. Never speak of them. Pretend they were nothing but a bad dream. But the victory tour makes that impossible. Strategically placed almost midway between the annual games, it is the capital's way of keeping the horror fresh and immediate. Not only are we in the districts forced to remember the iron grip of the capital's power each year, we are forced to celebrate it. And this year, I am one of the stars of the show. I will have to travel from district to district to stand before the cheering crowds who secretly loathe me, to look down into the faces of the families whose children I have killed. The sun persists in rising, so I make myself stand. All my joints complain, and my left leg has been asleep for so long that it takes several minutes of pacing to bring the feeling back into it. I've been in the woods 3 hours, but as I've made no real attempt at hunting, I have nothing to show for it. It doesn't matter for my mother and little sister Prim anymore. They can afford to buy butcher meat in town, although none of us likes it any better than fresh game. But my best friend, Gale Hawthorne, and his family will be depending on today's haul, and I can't let them down. I start the hour-and-a-half trek it will take to cover our snare line. Back when we were in school, we had time in the afternoons to check the line and hunt and gather and still get back to trade in town. But now that Gale has gone to work in the coal mines and I have nothing to do all day, I've taken over the job. By this time, Gale will have clocked in at the mines, taken the stomach-churning elevator ride into the depths of the earth, and be pounding away at a coal seam. I know what it's like down there. Every year in school, as part of our training, my class had to tour the mines. When I was little, it was just unpleasant. The claustrophobic tunnels, foul air, suffocating darkness on all sides. But after my father and several other miners were killed in an explosion, I could barely force myself onto the elevator. The annual trip became an enormous source of anxiety. Twice I made myself so sick in anticipation of it that my mother kept me home because she thought I had contracted the flu. I think of Gale, who was only really alive in the woods with its fresh air and sunlight and clean, flowing water. I don't know how he stands it. Well, yes, I do. He stands it because it's the way to feed his mother and 2 younger brothers and sister. And here I am with buckets of money, far more than enough to feed both our families now, and he won't take a single coin. It's even hard for him to let me bring in meat, although he'd surely have kept my mother and Prim supplied if I'd been killed in the games. I tell him he's doing me a favor, that it drives me nuts to sit around all day. Even so, I never drop off the game while he's at home, which is easy, since he works 12 hours a day. The only time I really get to see Gale now is on Sundays, when we meet up in the woods to hunt together. It's still the best day of the week, but it's not like it used to be before, when we could tell each other anything. The games have spoiled even that. I keep hoping that as time passes, we'll regain the ease between us, but part of me knows it's futile. There's no going back. I get a good haul from the traps, 8 rabbits, 2 squirrels, and a beaver that swam into a wire contraption Gale designed himself. He's something of a whiz with snares, rigging them to bent saplings so they pull the kill out of the reach of predators, balancing logs on delicate stick triggers, weaving inescapable baskets to capture fish. As I go along, carefully resetting each snare, I know I can never quite replicate his eye for balance, his instinct for where the prey will cross the path. It's more than experience. It's a natural gift. Like the way I can shoot at an animal in almost complete darkness and still take it down with one arrow. By the time I make it back to the fence that surrounds District 12, the sun is well up. As always, I listen a moment, but there's no telltale hum of electrical current running through the chain link. There hardly ever is, even though the thing is supposed to be charged full time. I wriggle through the opening at the bottom of the fence and come up in the meadow, just a stone's throw from my home, my old home. We still get to keep it, since officially it's the designated dwelling of my mother and sister. If I should drop dead right now, they would have to return to it. But at present, they're both happily installed in the new house in the Victor's village, and I'm the only one who uses the squat little place where I was raised. To me, it's my real home. I go there now to switch my clothes, exchange my father's old leather jacket for a fine wool coat that always seems too tight in the shoulders, leave my soft, worn hunting boots for a pair of expensive machine-made shoes that my mother thinks are more appropriate for someone of my status. I've already stowed my bow and arrows in a hollow log in the woods. Although time is ticking away, I allow myself a few minutes to sit in the kitchen. It has an abandoned quality with no fire on the hearth, no cloth on the table. I mourn my old life here. We barely scraped by, but I knew where I fit in. I knew what my place was in the tightly interwoven fabric that was our life. I wish I could go back to it because, in retrospect, it seems so secure compared with now, when I am so rich and so famous and so hated by the authorities in the capital. A wailing at the back door demands my attention. I open it to find Buttercup, Prim's scruffy old tomcat. He dislikes the new house almost as much as I do, and always leaves it when my sister's at school. We've never been particularly fond of each other, but now we have this new bond. I let him in, feed him a chunk of beaver fat, and even rub him between the ears for a bit. "You're hideous. You know that, right?" I ask him. Buttercup nudges my hand for more petting, but we have to go. "Come on, you." I scoop him up with one hand, grab my game bag with the other, and haul them both out onto the street. The cat springs free and disappears under a bush. The shoes pinch my toes as I crunch along the cinder street. Cutting down alleys and through backyards gets me to Gale's house in minutes. His mother, Hazel, sees me through the window where she's bent over the kitchen sink. She dries her hands on her apron and disappears to meet me at the door. I like Hazel. Respect her. The explosion that killed my father took out her husband as well, leaving her with 3 boys and a baby due any day. Less than a week after she gave birth, she was out hunting the streets for work. The mines weren't an option, what with a baby to look after, but she managed to get laundry from some of the merchants in town. At 14, Gail, the eldest of the kids, became the main supporter of the family. He was already signed up for tesserae, which entitled him to a meager supply of grain and oil in exchange for his entering his name extra times in the drawing to become a tribute. On top of that, even back then, he was a skilled trapper. But it wasn't enough to keep a family of five without Hazel working her fingers to the bone on that washboard. In winter, her hands got so red and cracked they bled at the slightest provocation. Still would if it wasn't for a salve my mother concocted. But they are determined, Hazel and Gail, that the other boys, 12-year-old Rory and 10-year-old Vic, and the baby, 4-year-old Posey, will never have to sign up for tesserae. Hazel smiles when she sees the game. She takes the beaver by the tail, feeling its weight. He's going to make a nice stew. Unlike Gail, she has no problem with our hunting arrangement. Good pelt, too, I answer. It's comforting here with Hazel, weighing the merits of the game, just as we always have. She pours me a mug of herb tea, which I wrap my chilled fingers around gratefully. You know, when I get back from the tour, I was thinking I might take Rory out with me sometimes, after school. Teach him to shoot. Hazel nods. That'd be good. Gail means to, but he's only got his Sundays, and I think he likes saving those for you. I can't stop the redness that floods my cheeks. It's stupid, of course. Hardly anybody knows me better than Hazel, knows the bond I share with Gail. I'm sure plenty of people assumed that we'd eventually get married, even if I never gave it any thought. But that was before the games. Before my fellow tribute, Peter Mellark, announced he was madly in love with me. Our romance became a key strategy for our survival in the arena. Only it wasn't just a strategy for Peter. I'm not sure what it was for me. But I know now it was nothing but painful for Gail. My chest tightens as I think about how, on the victory tour, Peter and I will have to present ourselves as lovers again. I gulp my tea, even though it's too hot, and push back from the table. I better get going. Make myself presentable for the cameras. Hazel hugs me. Enjoy the food. Absolutely, I say. My next stop is the Hob, where I've traditionally done the bulk of my trading. Years ago it was a warehouse to store coal, but when it fell into disuse it became a meeting place for illegal trades and then blossomed into a full-time black market. If it attracts a somewhat criminal element, then I belong here, I guess. Hunting in the woods surrounding District 12 violates at least a dozen laws and is punishable by death. Although they never mention it, I owe the people who frequent the Hob. Gail told me that Greasy Say, the old woman who serves up soup, started a collection to sponsor Peter and me during the games. It was supposed to be just a Hob thing, but a lot of other people heard about it and chipped in. I don't know exactly how much it was, and the price of any gift in the arena was exorbitant. But for all I know, it made the difference between my life and death. It's still odd to drag open the front door with an empty game bag, with nothing to trade, and instead feel the heavy pocket of coins against my hip. I try to hit as many stalls as possible, spreading out my purchases of coffee, buns, eggs, yarn, and oil. As an afterthought, I buy 3 bottles of white liquor from a one-armed woman named Ripper, a victim of a mine accident who was smart enough to find a way to stay alive. The liquor isn't for my family. It's for Hamish, who acted as mentor for Peeta and me in the games. He's surly, violent, and drunk most of the time. But he did his job, more than his job, because for the first time in history, 2 tributes were allowed to win. So no matter who Hamish is, I owe him, too. And that's for always. I'm getting the white liquor because a few weeks ago he ran out and there was none for sale, and he had a withdrawal, shaking and screaming at terrifying things only he could see. He scared Prim to death, and frankly, it wasn't much fun for me to see him like that either. Ever since then, I've been sort of stockpiling the stuff, just in case there's a shortage again. Cray, our head peacekeeper, frowns when he sees me with the bottles. He's an older man with a few strands of silver hair combed sideways above his bright red face.
"That stuff's too strong for you, girl."
He should know. Next to Haymitch, Cray drinks more than anyone I've ever met. "Oh, my mother uses it in medicines," I say indifferently.
"Well, it'd kill just about anything," he says,
and slaps down a coin for a bottle. When I reach Greasy Say's stall, I boost myself up to sit on the counter and order some soup, which looks to be some kind of gourd and bean mixture. A peacekeeper named Darius comes up and buys a bowl while I'm eating. As law enforcers go, he's one of my favorites, never really throwing his weight around, usually good for a joke. He's probably in his 20s, but he doesn't seem much older than I do. Something about his smile, his red hair that sticks out every which way, gives him a boyish quality.
"Aren't you supposed to be on a train?"
he asks me. "They're collecting me at noon," I answer.
"Shouldn't you look better?"
he asks in a loud whisper. I can't help smiling at his teasing, in spite of my mood.
"Maybe a ribbon in your hair or something?"
He flicks my braid with his hand, and I brush him away. "Don't worry, by the time they get through with me, I'll be unrecognizable," I say.
"Good,"
he says.
"Let's show a little district pride for a change, Miss Everdeen."
"Hmm?" He shakes his head at Greasy Say in mock disapproval and walks off to join his friends.
"I'll want that bowl back,"
Greasy Say calls after him, but since she's laughing, she doesn't sound particularly stern.
"Gail going to see you off?"
she asks me. "No, he wasn't on the list," I say. "I saw him Sunday, though."
"Think he'd have made the list, him being your cousin and all,"
she says wryly. It's just one more part of the lie the Capitol has concocted. When Peter and I made it into the final eight in the Hunger Games, they sent reporters to do personal stories about us. When they asked about my friends, everyone directed them to Gail. But it wouldn't do, what with the romance I was playing out in the arena, to have my best friend be Gail. He was too handsome, too male, and not the least bit willing to smile and play nice for the cameras. We do resemble each other, though, quite a bit. We have that seam look. Dark straight hair, olive skin, gray eyes. So some genius made him my cousin. I didn't know about it until we were already home, on the platform, at the train station, and my mother said, "Your cousins can hardly wait to see you." Then I turned and saw Gail and Hazel and all the kids waiting for me. So what could I do but go along? Greasy Say knows we're not related, but even some of the people who have known us for years seem to have forgotten. "I just can't wait for the whole thing to be over," I whisper.
"I know," says Greasy Say. "But you've got to go through it to get to the end of it. Better not be late."
A light snow starts to fall as I make my way to the Victor's Village. It's about a half-mile walk from the square in the center of town, but it seems like another world entirely. It's a separate community built around a beautiful green dotted with flowering bushes. There are 12 houses, each large enough to hold 10 of the one I was raised in. 9 stand empty, as they always have. The 3 in use belong to Haymitch, Peeta, and me. The houses inhabited by my family and Peeta give off a warm glow of life. Lit windows, smoke from the chimneys, bunches of brightly colored corn affixed to the front doors as decoration for the upcoming harvest festival. However, Haymitch's house, despite the care taken by the groundskeeper,
exudes an air of abandonment and neglect. I brace myself at his front door, knowing it will be foul, then push inside. My nose immediately wrinkles in disgust. Hamish refuses to let anyone in to clean and does a poor job himself. Over the years, the odors of liquor and vomit, boiled cabbage and burned meat, unwashed clothes and mouse droppings have intermingled into a stench that brings tears to my eyes. I wade through a litter of discarded wrappings, broken glass, and bones to where I know I will find Hamish. He sits at the kitchen table, his arms sprawled across the wood, his face in a puddle of liquor, snoring his head off. I nudge his shoulder. "Get up," I say loudly, because I've learned there's no subtle way to wake him. His snoring stops for a moment, questioningly, and then resumes. I push him harder. "Get up, Hamish! It's tour day!" I force the window up, inhaling deep breaths of the clean air outside. My feet shift through the garbage on the floor, and I unearth a tin coffee pot and fill it at the sink. The stove isn't completely out, and I manage to coax the few live coals into a flame. I pour some ground coffee into the pot, enough to make sure the resulting brew will be good and strong, and set it on the stove to boil. Hamish is still dead to the world. Since nothing else has worked, I fill a basin with icy cold water, dump it on his head, and spring out of the way. A guttural animal sound comes from his throat. He jumps up, kicking his chair 10 feet behind him and wielding a knife. I forgot he always sleeps with one clutched in his hand. I should have pried it from his fingers, but I've had a lot on my mind. Spewing profanity, he slashes the air a few moments before coming to his senses. He wipes his face on his shirt sleeve and turns to the windowsill where I perch, just in case I need to make a quick exit. "What are you doing?" he sputters. "You told me to wake you an hour before the cameras come," I say. "What?" he says. "Your idea," I insist. He seems to remember. "Why am I all wet?" "I couldn't shake you awake," I say. "Look, if you wanted to be babied, you should have asked PETA."
"Asked me what?"
Just the sound of his voice twists my stomach into a knot of unpleasant emotions like guilt, sadness, and fear, and longing. I might as well admit there's some of that, too. Only it has too much competition to ever win out. I watch as PETA crosses to the table, the sunlight from the window picking up the glint of fresh snow in his blonde hair. He looks strong and healthy, so different from the sick, starving boy I knew in the arena, and you can barely even notice his limp now. He sets a loaf of fresh-baked bread on the table and holds out his hand to Hamish.
"Asked you to wake me without giving me pneumonia," says Hamish, passing over his knife.
He pulls off his filthy shirt, revealing an equally soiled undershirt, and rubs himself down with the dry part. PETA smiles and douses Hamish's knife in white liquor from a bottle on the floor. He wipes the blade clean on his shirt tail and slices the bread. PETA keeps all of us in fresh-baked goods. I hunt, he bakes. Hamish drinks. We have our own ways to stay busy, to keep thoughts of our time as contestants in the Hunger Games at bay. It's not until he's handed Hamish the heel that he even looks at me for the first time.
"Would you like a piece?"
"No, I ate at the Hob," I say. "But thank you." My voice doesn't sound like my own. It's so formal, just as it's been every time I've spoken to PETA, since the cameras finished filming our happy homecoming and we returned to our real lives.
"You're welcome," he says back stiffly.
Hamish tosses his shirt somewhere into the mess.
"Brr! You two have got a lot of warming up to do before showtime."
He's right, of course. The audience will be expecting the pair of lovebirds who won the Hunger Games, not two people who can barely look each other in the eye.
but all I say is, "Take a bath, Haymitch." Then I swing out the window, drop to the ground, and head across the green to my house. The snow has begun to stick, and I leave a trail of footprints behind me. At the front door, I pause to knock the wet stuff from my shoes before I go in. My mother's been working day and night to make everything perfect for the cameras, so it's no time to be tracking up her shiny floors. I've barely stepped inside when she's there, holding my arm as if to stop me. "Don't worry, I'm taking them off here," I say, leaving my shoes on the mat. My mother gives an odd, breathy laugh and removes the game bag loaded with supplies from my shoulder. "It's just snow. Did you have a nice walk?"
"Walk?"
She knows I've been in the woods half the night. Then I see the man standing behind her in the kitchen doorway. One look at his tailored suit and surgically perfected features, and I know he's from the capital. Something is wrong.
"It was more like skating. It's really getting slippery out there."
"Someone's here to see you," says my mother. Her face is too pale, and I can hear the anxiety she's trying to hide.
"I thought they weren't due until noon."
I pretend not to notice her state.
"Did Cinna come early to help me get ready?"
"No, Katniss, it's..." my mother begins.
"This way, please, Miss Everdeen," says the man.
He gestures down the hallway. It's weird to be ushered around your own home, but I know better than to comment on it. As I go, I give my mother a reassuring smile over my shoulder.
"Probably more instructions for the tour.
They've been sending me all kinds of stuff about my itinerary and what protocol will be observed in each district." But as I walk toward the door of the study, a door I have never even seen closed until this moment, I can feel my mind begin to race. Who is here? What do they want? Why is my mother so pale?
"Go right in,"
says the capital man, who has followed me down the hallway. I twist the polished brass knob and step inside. My nose registers the conflicting scents of roses and blood. A small, white-haired man, who seems vaguely familiar, is reading a book. He holds up a finger as if to say, "Give me a moment." Then he turns, and my heart skips a beat. I'm staring into the snake-like eyes of President Snow. Chapter 2. In my mind, President Snow should be viewed in front of marble pillars hung with oversized flags. It's jarring to see him surrounded by the ordinary objects in the room. Like taking the lid off a pot and finding a fanged viper instead of stew. What could he be doing here? My mind rushes back to the opening days of other victory tours. I remember seeing the winning tributes with their mentors and stylists. Even some high government officials have made appearances occasionally. But I have never seen President Snow. He attends celebrations in the capital. Period. If he's made the journey all the way from his city, it can only mean one thing. I'm in serious trouble. And if I am, so is my family. A shiver goes through me when I think of the proximity of my mother and sister to this man who despises me, will always despise me, because I outsmarted his sadistic Hunger Games, made the capital look foolish, and consequently undermined his control. All I was doing was trying to keep Peeta and myself alive. Any act of rebellion was purely coincidental. But when the capital decrees that only one tribute can live, and you have the audacity to challenge it, I guess that's a rebellion in itself. My only defense was pretending that I was driven insane by a passionate love for Peeta, so we were both allowed to live, to be crowned victors, to go home and celebrate and wave goodbye to the cameras and be left alone. Until now. Perhaps it is the newness of the house,
or the shock of seeing him, or the mutual understanding that he could have me killed in a second that makes me feel like the intruder, as if this is his home and I'm the uninvited party. So I don't welcome him or offer him a chair. I don't say anything. In fact, I treat him as if he's a real snake, the venomous kind. I stand motionless, my eyes locked on him, considering plans of retreat.
I think we'll make this whole situation a lot simpler by agreeing not to lie to each other, he says. What do you think?
I think my tongue has frozen and speech will be impossible, so I surprise myself by answering back in a steady voice. Yes, I think that would save time.
President Snow smiles, and I notice his lips for the first time.
I'm expecting snake lips, which is to say, none. But his are overly full, the skin stretched too tight. I have to wonder if his mouth has been altered to make him more appealing. If so, it was a waste of time and money, because he's not appealing at all.
My advisors were concerned you would be difficult. But you're not planning on being difficult, are you?
He asks. No, I answer.
That's what I told them. I said any girl who goes to such lengths to preserve her life isn't going to be interested in throwing it away with both hands. And then there's her family to think of. Her mother, her sister, and all those cousins.
By the way he lingers on the word cousins, I can tell he knows that Gail and I don't share a family tree.
Well, it's all on the table now.
Maybe that's better. I don't do well with ambiguous threats. I'd much rather know the score.
Let's sit.
President Snow takes a seat at the large desk of polished wood, where Prim does her homework and my mother her budgets. Like our home, this is a place that he has no right, but ultimately every right, to occupy. I sit in front of the desk on one of the carved, straight-backed chairs. It's made for someone taller than I am, so only my toes rest on the ground.
I have a problem, Miss Everdeen, says President Snow. A problem that began the moment you pulled out those poisonous berries in the arena.
That was the moment when I guessed that if the game makers had to choose between watching PETA and me commit suicide, which would mean having no victor, and letting us both live, they would take the latter.
If the head game maker, Seneca Crane, had had any brains, he'd have blown you to dust right then. But he had an unfortunate sentimental streak. So here you are. Can you guess where he is? He asks.
I nod because, by the way he says it, it's clear that Seneca Crane has been executed. The smell of roses and blood has grown stronger now that only a desk separates us. There's a rose in President Snow's lapel, which at least suggests a source of the flower perfume. But it must be genetically enhanced, because no real rose reeks like that. As for the blood, I don't know.
After that, there was nothing to do but let you play out your little scenario. And you were pretty good, too, with the love-crazed schoolgirl bit. The people in the capital were quite convinced. Unfortunately, not everyone in the districts fell for your act, he says.
My face must register at least a flicker of bewilderment, because he addresses it.
This, of course, you don't know. You have no access to information about the mood in other districts. In several of them, however, people viewed your little trick with the berries as an act of defiance, not an act of love. And if a girl from District 12, of all places, can defy the capital and walk away unharmed, what is to stop them from doing the same? He says. What is to prevent, say, an uprising?
It takes a moment for his last sentence to sink in. Then the full weight of it hits me. "There have been uprisings?" I ask, both chilled and somewhat elated by the possibility.
"Not yet. But they'll follow if the course of things doesn't change. And uprisings have been known to lead to revolution."
President Snow rubs a spot over his left eyebrow, the very spot where I myself get headaches.
"Do you have any idea what that would mean? How many people would die? What conditions those left would have to face? Whatever problems anyone may have with the capital, believe me when I say that if it released its grip on the districts for even a short time, the entire system would collapse."
I'm taken aback by the directness and even the sincerity of this speech. As if his primary concern is the welfare of the citizens of Panem, when nothing could be further from the truth. I don't know how I dare to say the next words, but I do. "It must be very fragile if a handful of berries can bring it down." There's a long pause while he examines me. Then he simply says,
"It is fragile, but not in the way that you suppose."
There's a knock at the door, and the capital man sticks his head in.
"Her mother wants to know if you want tea." I would like tea," says the president.
The door opens wider, and there stands my mother, holding a tray with a china tea set she brought to the seam when she married.
"Set it here, please."
He places his book on the corner of the desk and pats the center. My mother sets the tray on the desk. It holds a china teapot and cups, cream and sugar, and a plate of cookies. They are beautifully iced with softly colored flowers. The frosting work can only be Peeta's.
"What a welcome sight. You know, it's funny how often people forget that presidents need to eat too,"
President Snow says charmingly. Well, it seems to relax my mother a bit, anyway. "Can I get you anything else? I can cook something more substantial if you're hungry," she offers.
"No, this could not be more perfect."
"Thank you," he says, clearly dismissing her. My mother nods, shoots me a glance, and goes. President Snow pours tea for both of us and fills his with cream and sugar, then takes a long time stirring. I sense he has had his say and is waiting for me to respond. "I didn't mean to start any uprisings," I tell him.
"I believe you. It doesn't matter. Your stylist turned out to be prophetic in his wardrobe choice. Katniss Everdeen, the girl who was on fire, you have provided a spark that, left unattended, may grow to an inferno that destroys Panem," he says.
"Why don't you just kill me now?" I blurt out.
"Publicly?" he asks. "That would only add fuel to the flames."
"Arrange an accident, then," I say.
"Who would buy it?" he asks. "Not you, if you were watching."
"Then just tell me what you want me to do. I'll do it," I say.
"If only it were that simple."
He picks up one of the flowered cookies and examines it.
"Lovely. Your mother made these?"
"Peeta." And for the first time I find I can't hold his gaze. I reach for my tea, but set it back down when I hear the cup rattling against the saucer. To cover, I quickly take a cookie.
"Peeta, how is the love of your life?" he asks.
"Good," I say.
"At what point did he realize the exact degree of your indifference?" he asks,
dipping his cookie in his tea. "I'm not indifferent," I say.
"But perhaps not as taken with the young man as you would have the country believe," he says.
"Who says I'm not?" I say.
"I do," says the president. "And I wouldn't be here if I were the only person who had doubts. How's the handsome cousin?"
"I don't know. I don't..." My revulsion at this conversation, at discussing my feelings for two of the people I care most about with President Snow, chokes me off.
Speak, Miss Everdeen. Him I can easily kill off if we don't come to a happy resolution, he says. You aren't doing him a favor by disappearing into the woods with him each Sunday.
If he knows this, what else does he know? And how does he know it? Many people could tell him that Gale and I spend our Sundays hunting. Don't we show up at the end of each one loaded down with game? Haven't we for years? The real question is what he thinks goes on in the woods beyond District 12. Surely they haven't been tracking us in there. Or have they? Could we have been followed? That seems impossible. At least by a person. Cameras? That never crossed my mind until this moment. The woods have always been our place of safety, our place beyond the reach of the capital, where we're free to say what we feel, be who we are. At least before the games. If we've been watched since, what have they seen? Two people hunting? Saying treasonous things against the capital, yes. But not two people in love, which seems to be President Snow's implication. We're safe on that charge. Unless... It only happened once. It was fast and unexpected, but it did happen. After Peter and I got home from the games, it was several weeks before I saw Gale alone. First, there were the obligatory celebrations. A banquet for the victors that only the most high-ranking people were invited to. A holiday for the whole district, with free food and entertainers brought in from the capital. Parcel Day, the first of 12, in which food packages were delivered to every person in the district. That was my favorite. To see all those hungry kids in the seam running around, waving cans of applesauce, tins of meat, even candy. Back home, too big to carry, would be bags of grain, cans of oil. To know that once a month for a year, they would all receive another parcel. That was one of the few times I actually felt good about winning the games. So between the ceremonies and events and the reporters documenting my every move, as I presided and thanked and kissed Peter for the audience, I had no privacy at all. After a few weeks, things finally died down. The camera crews and reporters packed up and went home. Peter and I assumed the cool relationship we've had ever since. My family settled into our house in the Victor's Village. The everyday life of District 12, workers to the mines, kids to school, resumed its usual pace. I waited until I thought the coast was really clear, and then one Sunday, without telling anyone, I got up hours before dawn and took off for the woods. The weather was still warm enough that I didn't need a jacket. I packed along a bag filled with special foods, cold chicken and cheese, and bakery bread and oranges. Down at my old house, I put on my hunting boots. As usual, the fence was not charged, and it was simple to slip into the woods and retrieve my bow and arrows. I went to our place, Gale's and mine, where we had shared breakfast the morning of the reaping that sent me into the games. I waited at least 2 hours. I'd begun to think that he'd given up on me in the weeks that had passed, or that he no longer cared about me, hated me even. And the idea of losing him forever, my best friend, the only person I'd ever trusted with my secrets, was so painful I couldn't stand it. Not on top of everything else that had happened. I could feel my eyes tearing up and my throat starting to close the way it does when I get upset. Then I looked up, and there he was, 10 feet away, just watching me. Without even thinking, I jumped up and threw my arms around him, making some weird sound that combined laughing, choking, and crying. He was holding me so tightly that I couldn't see his face. But it was a really long time before he let me go, and then he didn't have much choice, because I'd gotten this unbelievably loud case of the hiccups and had to get a drink. We did what we always did that day, ate breakfast, hunted and fished and gathered, talked about people in town, but not about us, his new life in the mines, my time in the arena, just about other things. By the time we were at the hole in the fence that's nearest the hob, I think I really believed that things could be the same, that we could go on as we always had. I'd given all the game to Gale to trade since we had so much food now. I told him I'd skip the hob, even though I was looking forward to going there, because my mother and sister didn't even know I'd gone hunting, and they'd be wondering where I was. Then suddenly, as I was suggesting I take over the daily snare run, he took my face in his hands and kissed me. I was completely unprepared. You would think that after all the hours I'd spent with Gale, watching him talk and laugh and frown, that I would know all there was to know about his lips. But I hadn't imagined how warm they would feel pressed against my own, or how those hands, which could set the most intricate of snares, could as easily entrap me. I think I made some sort of noise in the back of my throat, and I vaguely remember my fingers, curled tightly closed, resting on his chest. Then he let go and said,
"I had to do that, at least once."
And he was gone, despite the fact that the sun was setting and my family would be worried. I sat by a tree next to the fence. I tried to decide how I felt about the kiss, if I had liked it or resented it, but all I really remembered was the pressure of Gale's lips and the scent of the oranges that still lingered on his skin. It was pointless comparing it with the many kisses I'd exchanged with Peter. I still hadn't figured out if any of those counted. Finally, I went home. That week I managed the snares and dropped off the meat with Hazel. But I didn't see Gale until Sunday. I had this whole speech worked out about how I didn't want a boyfriend and never planned on marrying. But I didn't end up using it. Gale acted as if the kiss had never happened. Maybe he was waiting for me to say something, or kiss him back. Instead, I just pretended it had never happened either. But it had. Gale had shattered some invisible barrier between us, and with it, any hope I had of resuming our old, uncomplicated friendship. Whatever I pretended, I could never look at his lips in quite the same way. This all flashes through my head in an instant as President Snow's eyes bore into me on the heels of his threat to kill Gale. How stupid I've been to think the Capitol would just ignore me once I returned home. Maybe I didn't know about the potential uprisings, but I knew they were angry with me. Instead of acting with the extreme caution the situation called for, what have I done? From the president's point of view, I've ignored Peter and flaunted my preference for Gale's company before the whole district, and by doing so made it clear I was, in fact, mocking the Capitol. Now I've endangered Gale and his family, and my family and Peter, too, by my carelessness. "Please don't hurt Gale," I whisper. "He's just my friend. He's been my friend for years. That's all that's between us. Besides, everyone thinks we're cousins now."
"I'm only interested in how it affects your dynamic with Peter, thereby affecting the mood in the districts," he says.
"It will be the same on the tour. I'll be in love with him just as I was," I say.
"Just as you are," corrects President Snow.
"Just as I am," I confirm.
"Only you'll have to do even better if the uprisings are to be averted," he says. "This tour will be your only chance to turn things around."
"I know. I will. I'll convince everyone in the districts that I wasn't defying the Capitol, that I was crazy with love," I say. President Snow rises and dabs his puffy lips with a napkin.
"Aim higher in case you fall short."
"What do you mean? How can I aim higher?" I ask.
"Convince me," he says.
He drops the napkin and retrieves his book. I don't watch him as he heads for the door, so I flinch when he whispers in my ear,
"By the way, I know about the kiss."
Then the door clicks shut behind him.
Chapter 3. The smell of blood. It was on his breath. What does he do, I think? Drink it? I imagine him sipping from a teacup, dipping a cookie into the stuff and pulling it out, dripping red. Outside the window, a car comes to life, soft and quiet like the purr of a cat, then fades away into the distance. It slips off as it arrived, unnoticed. The room seems to be spinning in slow, lopsided circles, and I wonder if I might black out. I lean forward and clutch the desk with one hand. The other still holds Peeta's beautiful cookie. I think it had a tiger lily on it, but now it's been reduced to crumbs in my fist. I didn't even know I was crushing it, but I guess I had to hold on to something while my world veered out of control. A visit from President Snow. Districts on the verge of uprisings. A direct death threat to Gale, with others to follow. Everyone I love, doomed. And who knows who else will pay for my actions? Unless I turn things around on this tour. Quiet the discontent and put the president's mind at rest. And how? By proving to the country beyond any shadow of a doubt that I love Peeta Mellark? I can't do it, I think. I'm not that good. Peeta's the good one, the likable one. He can make people believe anything. I'm the one who shuts up and sits back and lets him do as much of the talking as possible. But it isn't Peeta who has to prove his devotion. It's me. I hear my mother's light, quick tread in the hall. She can't know, I think. Not about any of this. I reach my hands over the tray and quickly brush the bits of cookie from my palm and fingers. I take a shaky sip of my tea. "Is everything all right, Katniss?" she asks. "It's fine. We never see it on television, but the president always visits the victors before the tour to wish them luck," I say brightly. My mother's face floods with relief. "Oh, I thought there was some kind of trouble." "No, not at all," I say. "The trouble will start when my prep team sees how I've let my eyebrows grow back in." My mother laughs, and I think about how there was no going back after I took over caring for the family when I was 11. How I will always have to protect her. "Why don't I start your bath?" she asks. "Great," I say, and I can see how pleased she is by my response. Since I've been home, I've been trying hard to mend my relationship with my mother, asking her to do things for me instead of brushing aside any offer of help, as I did for years out of anger, letting her handle all the money I won, returning her hugs instead of tolerating them. My time in the arena made me realize how I needed to stop punishing her for something she couldn't help, specifically the crushing depression she fell into after my father's death. Because sometimes things happen to people and they're not equipped to deal with them. Like me, for instance. Right now. Besides, there's one wonderful thing she did when I arrived back in the district. After our families and friends had greeted Peeta and me at the train station, there were a few questions allowed from reporters. Someone asked my mother what she thought of my new boyfriend, and she replied that while Peeta was the very model of what a young man should be, I wasn't old enough to have any boyfriend at all. She followed this with a pointed look at Peeta. There was a lot of laughter and comments like, "Somebody's in trouble," from the press, and Peeta dropped my hand and sidestepped away from me. That didn't last long. There was too much pressure to act otherwise, but it gave us an excuse to be a little more reserved than we'd been in the capital, and maybe it can help account for how little I've been seen in Peeta's company since the cameras left. I go upstairs to the bathroom, where a steaming tub awaits. My mother has added a small bag of dried flowers that perfumes the air. None of us are used to the luxury of turning on a tap and having a limitless supply of hot water at our fingertips.
We had only cold at our home in the seam, and a bath meant boiling the rest over the fire. I undress and lower myself into the silky water. My mother has poured in some kind of oil as well, and try to get a grip on things. The first question is, who to tell, if anyone? Not my mother or Prim, obviously. They'd only become sick with worry. Not Gale. Even if I could get word to him, what would he do with the information anyway? If he were alone, I might try to persuade him to run away. Certainly, he could survive in the woods. But he's not alone, and he'd never leave his family. Or me. When I get home, I'll have to tell him something about why our Sundays are a thing of the past. But I can't think about that now. Only about my next move. Besides, Gale's already so angry and frustrated with the capital that I sometimes think he's going to arrange his own uprising. The last thing he needs is an incentive. No, I can't tell anyone I'm leaving behind in District 12. There are still three people I might confide in, starting with Cinna, my stylist. But my guess is Cinna might already be at risk, and I don't want to pull him into any more trouble by closer association with me. Then there's Peeta, who will be my partner in this deception, but how do I begin that conversation? Hey, Peeta, remember how I told you I was kind of faking being in love with you? Well, I really need you to forget about that now and act extra in love with me, or the president might kill Gale. I can't do it. Besides, Peeta will perform well whether he knows what's at stake or not. That leaves Haymitch. Drunken, cranky, confrontational Haymitch, who I just poured a basin of ice water on. As my mentor in the games, it was his duty to keep me alive. I only hope he's still up for the job. I slide down into the water, letting it block out the sounds around me. I wish the tub would expand so I could go swimming like I used to on hot summer Sundays in the woods with my father. Those days were a special treat. We would leave early in the morning and hike farther into the woods than usual to a small lake he'd found while hunting. I don't even remember learning to swim. I was so young when he taught me. I just remember diving, turning somersaults, and paddling around, the muddy bottom of the lake beneath my toes, the smell of blossoms and greenery, floating on my back, as I am now, staring at the blue sky while the chatter of the woods was muted by the water. He'd bag the waterfowl that nested around the shore. I'd hunt for eggs in the grasses, and we'd both dig for catnip roots, the plant for which he named me in the shallows. At night, when we got home, my mother would pretend not to recognize me because I was so clean. Then she'd cook up an amazing dinner of roasted duck and baked catnip tubers with gravy. I never took Gale to the lake. I could have. It's time-consuming to get there, but the waterfowl are such easy pickings, you can make up for lost hunting time. It's a place I've never really wanted to share with anyone, though, a place that belonged only to my father and me. Since the games, when I've had little to occupy my days, I've gone there a couple of times. The swimming was still nice, but mostly the visits depressed me. Over the course of the last 5 years, the lake's remarkably unchanged, and I'm almost unrecognizable. Even underwater I can hear the sounds of commotion, honking car horns, shouts of greeting, doors banging shut. It can only mean my entourage has arrived. I just have time to towel off and slip into a robe before my prep team bursts into the bathroom. There's no question of privacy. When it comes to my body, we have no secrets, these three people and me.
Katniss, your eyebrows!
Venia shrieks right off, and even with the black cloud hanging over me, I have to stifle a laugh. Her aqua hair has been styled so it sticks out in sharp points all over her head,
and the gold tattoos that used to be confined above her brows have curled around under her eyes, all contributing to the impression that I've literally shocked her. Octavia comes up and pats Venia's back soothingly, her curvy body looking plumper than usual next to Venia's thin, angular one.
There, there, you can fix those in no time.
But what am I going to do with these nails?
She grabs my hand and pins it flat between her two pea-green ones. No, her skin isn't exactly pea-green now. It's more of a light evergreen. The shift in shade is no doubt an attempt to stay abreast of the capricious fashion trends of the capital.
Really, Katniss, you could have left me something to work with, she wails.
It's true. I've bitten my nails to stubs in the past couple of months. I thought about trying to break the habit, but couldn't think of a good reason I should. Sorry, I mutter. I hadn't really been spending much time worrying about how it might affect my prep team. Flavius lifts a few strands of my wet, tangled hair. He gives his head a disapproving shake, causing his orange corkscrew curls to bounce around.
"Has anyone touched this since you last saw us?" he asks sternly. "Remember, we specifically asked you to leave your hair alone."
"Yes," I say, grateful that I can show I haven't totally taken them for granted. "I mean, no, no one's cut it. I did remember that."
No, I didn't. It's more like the issue never came up. Since I've been home, all I've done is stick it in its usual old braid down my back. This seems to mollify them, and they all kiss me, set me on a chair in my bedroom, and as usual, start talking non-stop without bothering to notice if I'm listening. While Venia reinvents my eyebrows, and Octavia gives me fake nails, and Flavius massages goo into my hair, I hear all about the capital. What a hit the games were, how dull things have been since, how no one can wait until Peter and I visit again at the end of the victory tour. After that, it won't be long before the capital begins gearing up for the quarter quell.
Isn't it thrilling?
Don't you feel so lucky?
In your very first year of being a victor, you get to be a mentor in a quarter quell.
Their words overlap in a blur of excitement. Oh, yes, I say neutrally. It's the best I can do. In a normal year, being a mentor to the tributes is the stuff of nightmares. I can't walk by the school now without wondering what kid I'll have to coach. But to make things even worse, this is the year of the 75th Hunger Games, and that means it's also a quarter quell. They occur every 25 years, marking the anniversary of the district's defeat, with over-the-top celebrations and, for extra fun, some miserable twist for the tributes. I've never been alive for one, of course, but in school I remember hearing that for the second quarter quell, the capital demanded that twice the number of tributes be provided for the arena. The teachers didn't go into much more detail, which is surprising, because that was the year District 12's very own Haymitch Abernathy won the crown.
"Haymitch better be preparing himself for a lot of attention," squeals Octavia.
Haymitch has never mentioned his personal experience in the arena to me. I would never ask. And if I ever saw his games televised in reruns, I must have been too young to remember it. But the capital won't let him forget it this year. In a way, it's a good thing Peter and I will both be available as mentors during the quell, because it's a sure bet that Haymitch will be wasted. After they've exhausted the topic of the quarter quell, my prep team launches into a whole lot of stuff about their incomprehensibly silly lives. Who said what about someone I've never heard of, and what sort of shoes they just bought, and a long story from Octavia about what a mistake it was to have everyone wear feathers to her birthday party. Soon my brows are stinging, my hair's smooth and silky, and my nails are ready to be painted. Apparently, they've been given instruction to prepare only my hands and face, probably because everything else will be covered in the cold weather.
Flavius badly wants to use his own trademark purple lipstick on me, but resigns himself to a pink as they begin to color my face and nails. I can see by the palette Cinna has assigned that we're going for girlish, not sexy. Good. I'll never convince anyone of anything if I'm trying to be provocative. Hamish made that very clear when he was coaching me for my interview for the games. My mother comes in, somewhat shyly, and says that Cinna has asked her to show the preps how she did my hair the day of the reaping. They respond with enthusiasm and then watch, thoroughly engrossed, as she breaks down the process of the elaborate braided hairdo. In the mirror, I can see their earnest faces following her every move, their eagerness when it is their turn to try a step. In fact, all three are so readily respectful and nice to my mother that I feel bad about how I go around feeling so superior to them. Who knows who I would be or what I would talk about if I'd been raised in the capital? Maybe my biggest regret would be having feathered costumes at my birthday party, too. When my hair is done, I find Cinna downstairs in the living room, and just the sight of him makes me feel more hopeful. He looks the same as always, simple clothes, short brown hair, just a hint of gold eyeliner. We embrace, and I can barely keep from spilling out the entire episode with President Snow. But no, I've decided to tell Hamish first. He'll know best who to burden with it. It's so easy to talk to Cinna, though. Lately we've been speaking a lot on the telephone that came with the house. It's sort of a joke, because almost no one else we know owns one. There's Peter, but obviously I don't call him. Hamish tore his out of the wall years ago. My friend Madge, the mayor's daughter, has a telephone in her house, but if we want to talk, we do it in person. At first, the thing barely ever got used. Then Cinna started to call to work on my talent. Every victor is supposed to have one. Your talent is the activity you take up since you don't have to work either in school or your district's industry. It can be anything, really. Anything that they can interview you about. Peter, it turns out, actually has a talent, which is painting. He's been frosting those cakes and cookies for years in his family's bakery. But now that he's rich, he can afford to smear real paint on canvases. I don't have a talent, unless you count hunting illegally, which they don't. Or maybe singing, which I wouldn't do for the capital in a million years. My mother tried to interest me in a variety of suitable alternatives from a list Effie Trinket sent her. Cooking, flower arranging, playing the flute. None of them took, although Prim had a knack for all three. Finally, Cinna stepped in and offered to help me develop my passion for designing clothes, which really required development since it was non-existent. But I said yes because it meant getting to talk to Cinna, and he promised he'd do all the work. Now he's arranging things around my living room, clothing, fabrics, and sketchbooks with designs he's drawn. I pick up one of the sketchbooks and examine a dress I supposedly created. "You know, I think I show a lot of promise," I say. "Get dressed, you worthless thing," he says, tossing a bundle of clothes at me. I may have no interest in designing clothes, but I do love the ones Cinna makes for me. Like these, flowing black pants made of a thick, warm material. A comfortable white shirt. A sweater woven from green and blue and gray strands of kitten-soft wool. Laced leather boots that don't pinch my toes. Did I design my outfit? I ask. No, you aspire to design your outfit and be like me, your fashion hero, says Cinna. He hands me a small stack of cards. You'll read these off camera while they're filming the clothes. Try to sound like you care. Just then, Effie Trinket arrives in a pumpkin-orange wig to remind everyone, we're on the schedule! She kisses me on both cheeks while waving in the camera crew, then orders me into position. Effie's the only reason we got anywhere on time in the capital, so I try to accommodate her. I start bobbing around like a puppet, holding up outfits and saying meaningless things like,
Don't you love it?
The sound team records me reading from my cards in a chirpy voice so they can insert it later. Then I'm tossed out of the room so they can film my, Cinna's, designs in peace. Prim got out early from school for the event. Now she stands in the kitchen, being interviewed by another crew. She looks lovely in a sky-blue frock that brings out her eyes, her blonde hair pulled back in a matching ribbon. She's leaning a bit forward on the toes of her shiny white boots, like she's about to take flight. Like, bam! It's like someone actually hits me in the chest. No one has, of course, but the pain is so real, I take a step back. I squeeze my eyes shut, and I don't see Prim. I see Rue, the 12-year-old girl from District 11, who was my ally in the arena. She could fly, bird-like, from tree to tree, catching on to the slenderest branches. Rue, who I didn't save, who I let die. I picture her lying on the ground with the spear still wedged in her stomach. Who else will I fail to save from the capital's vengeance? Who else will be dead if I don't satisfy President Snow? I realize Cinna's trying to put a coat on me, so I raise my arms. I feel fur inside and out encasing me. It's from no animal I've ever seen. Ermine, he tells me as I stroke the white sleeve. Leather gloves. A bright red scarf. Something furry covers my ears.
You're bringing earmuffs back in style.
I hate earmuffs, I think. They make it hard to hear, and since I was blasted deaf in one ear in the arena, I dislike them even more. After I won, the Capitol repaired my ear, but I still find myself testing it. My mother hurries up with something cupped in her hand. For good luck, she says. It's the pin Madge gave me before I left for the games. A mockingjay flying in a circle of gold. I tried to give it to Rue, but she wouldn't take it. She said the pin was the reason she'd decided to trust me. Cinna fixes it on the knot in the scarf. Effie Trinket's nearby, clapping her hands.
Attention, everyone! We're about to do the first outdoor shot, where the victors greet each other at the beginning of their marvelous trip. All right, Katniss, big smile. You're very excited, right?
I don't exaggerate when I say she shoves me out the door. For a moment I can't quite see right because of the snow, which is now coming down in earnest. Then I make out Peter coming through his front door. In my head I hear President Snow's directive, "Convince me." And I know I must. My face breaks into a huge smile, and I start walking in Peter's direction. Then, as if I can't stand it another second, I start running. He catches me and spins me around, and then he slips. He still isn't entirely in command of his artificial leg, and we fall into the snow, me on top of him. And that's where we have our first kiss in months. It's full of fur and snowflakes and lipstick. But underneath all that, I can feel the steadiness that Peter brings to everything, and I know I'm not alone. As badly as I have hurt him, he won't expose me in front of the cameras, won't condemn me with a half-hearted kiss. He's still looking out for me, just as he did in the arena. Somehow the thought makes me want to cry. Instead, I pull him to his feet, tuck my glove through the crook of his arm, and merrily pull him on our way. The rest of the day is a blur of getting to the station, bidding everyone goodbye, the train pulling out, the old team, Peter and me, Effie and Hamish, Cinna and Portia, Peter's stylist, dining on an indescribably delicious meal I don't remember. And then I'm swathed in pajamas and a voluminous robe, sitting in my plush compartment, waiting for the others to go to sleep. I know Hamish will be up for hours. He doesn't like to sleep when it's dark out. When the train seems quiet, I put on my slippers and pad down to his door.
I have to knock several times before he answers, scowling, as if he's certain I've brought bad news.
"What do you want?"
he says, nearly knocking me out with a cloud of wine fumes.
"I have to talk to you,"
I whisper.
"Now?"
he says. I nod.
"This better be good."
He waits, but I feel certain every word we utter on a capital train is being recorded.
"Well?"
he barks. The train starts to break, and for a second, I think President Snow is watching me and doesn't approve of my confiding in Haymitch and has decided to go ahead and kill me now. But we're just stopping for fuel.
"The train's so stuffy," I say.
It's a harmless phrase, but I see Haymitch's eyes narrow in understanding.
"I know what you need."
He pushes past me and lurches down the hall to a door. When he wrestles it open, a blast of snow hits us. He trips out onto the ground. A capital attendant rushes to help, but Haymitch waves her away good-naturedly as he staggers off.
"Just want some fresh air. Only be a minute."
"Sorry, he's drunk," I say apologetically. "I'll get him." I hop down and stumble along the track behind him, soaking my slippers with snow, as he leads me beyond the end of the train so we will not be overheard. Then he turns on me.
"What?"
I tell him everything. About the president's visit, about Gale, about how we're all going to die if I fail. His face sobers, grows older in the glow of the red taillights.
"Then you can't fail."
"If you could just help me get through this trip," I begin.
"No, Katniss, it's not just this trip,"
he says. "What do you mean?" I say.
"Even if you pull it off, they'll be back in another few months to take us all to the games. You and PETA, you'll be mentors now, every year from here on out, and every year they'll revisit the romance and broadcast the details of your private life, and you'll never, ever be able to do anything but live happily ever after with that boy."
The full impact of what he's saying hits me. I will never have a life with Gale, even if I want to. I will never be allowed to live alone. I will have to be forever in love with PETA. The capital will insist on it. I'll have a few years, maybe, because I'm still only 16, to stay with my mother in Prim. And then...
"Do you understand what I mean?"
He presses me. I nod. He means there's only one future if I want to keep those I love alive and stay alive myself. I'll have to marry PETA. Chapter 4. We slog back to the train in silence. In the hallway outside my door, Haymitch gives my shoulder a pat and says,
"You could do a lot worse, you know."
He heads off to his compartment, taking the smell of wine with him. In my room, I remove my sodden slippers, my wet robe and pajamas. There are more in the drawers, but I just crawl between the covers of my bed in my underclothes. I stare into the darkness, thinking about my conversation with Haymitch. Everything he said was true about the capital's expectations, my future with PETA, even his last comment. Of course, I could do a lot worse than PETA. That isn't really the point, though, is it? One of the few freedoms we have in District 12 is the right to marry who we want or not marry at all. And now even that has been taken away from me. I wonder if President Snow will insist we have children. If we do, they'll have to face the reaping each year. And wouldn't it be something to see the child of not one but two victors chosen for the arena? Victor's children have been in the ring before. It always causes a lot of excitement and generates talk about how the odds are not in that family's favor. But it happens too frequently to just be about odds. Gale's convinced the capital does it on purpose, rigs the drawings to add extra drama. Given all the trouble I've caused, I've probably guaranteed any child of mine a spot in the games. I think of Haymitch.
unmarried, no family, blotting out the world with drink. He could have had his choice of any woman in the district, and he chose solitude. Not solitude, that sounds too peaceful. More like solitary confinement. Was it because, having been in the arena, he knew it was better than risking the alternative? I had a taste of that alternative when they called Prim's name on Reaping Day, and I watched her walk to the stage to her death. But as her sister, I could take her place, an option forbidden to our mother. My mind searches frantically for a way out. I can't let President Snow condemn me to this, even if it means taking my own life. Before that, though, I'd try to run away. What would they do if I simply vanished? Disappeared into the woods and never came out? Could I even manage to take everyone I love with me? Start a new life deep in the wild? Highly unlikely, but not impossible. I shake my head to clear it. This is not the time to be making wild escape plans. I must focus on the victory tour. Too many people's fates depend on my giving a good show. Dawn comes before sleep does, and there's Effie rapping on my door. I pull on whatever clothes are at the top of the drawer and drag myself down to the dining car. I don't see what difference it makes when I get up, since this is a travel day, but then it turns out that yesterday's makeover was just to get me to the train station. Today I'll get the works from my prep team. "Why, it's too cold for anything to show," I grumble. "Not in District 11," says Effie. District 11, our first stop. I'd rather start in any other district, since this was Rue's home. But that's not how the victory tour works. Usually it kicks off in 12 and then goes in descending district order to 1, followed by the capital. The victor's district is skipped and saved for very last. Since 12 puts on the least fabulous celebration, usually just a dinner for the tributes and a victory rally in the square, where nobody looks like they're having any fun, it's probably best to get us out of the way as soon as possible. This year, for the first time since Haymitch won, the final stop on the tour will be 12, and the capital will spring for the festivities. I try to enjoy the food like Hazel said. The kitchen staff clearly wants to please me. They've prepared my favorite lamb stew with dried plums, among other delicacies. Orange juice and a pot of steaming hot chocolate wait at my place at the table. So I eat a lot, and the meal is beyond reproach. But I can't say I'm enjoying it. I'm also annoyed that no one but Effie and I has shown up. "Where's everybody else?" I ask. "Oh, who knows where Haymitch is," says Effie. I didn't really expect Haymitch, because he's probably just getting to bed. "Sinner was up late working on organizing your garment car. He must have over 100 outfits for you. Your evening clothes are exquisite. And Peter's team is probably still asleep." "Doesn't he need prepping?" I ask.
"Not the way you do,"
Effie replies.
What does this mean?
It means I get to spend the morning having my hair ripped off my body while Peter sleeps in. I hadn't thought about it much, but in the arena at least some of the boys got to keep their body hair, whereas none of the girls did. I can remember Peter's now as I bathed him by the stream. Very blonde in the sunlight, once the mud and blood had been washed away. Only his face remained completely smooth. Not one of the boys grew a beard, and many were old enough to. I wonder what they did to them. If I feel ragged, my prep team seems in worse condition, knocking back coffee and sharing brightly colored little pills. As far as I can tell, they never get up before noon unless there's some sort of national emergency, like my leg hair. I was so happy when it grew back in, too, as if it were a sign that things might be returning to normal. I run my fingers along the soft, curly down on my legs and give myself over to the team.
None of them are up to their usual chatter, so I can hear every strand being yanked from its follicle. I have to soak in a tub full of a thick, unpleasant-smelling solution, while my face and hair are plastered with creams. Two more baths follow in other, less offensive concoctions. I'm plucked and scoured and massaged and anointed until I'm raw. Flavius tilts up my chin and sighs.
It's a shame Cinna said no alterations on you.
Yes, we could really make you something special, says Octavia.
When she's older, says Venia, almost grimly. Then he'll have to let us.
Do what? Blow my lips up like President Snow's? Tattoo my breasts? Dye my skin magenta and implant gems in it? Cut decorative patterns in my face? Give me curved talons or cat's whiskers? I saw all these things and more on the people in the capital. Do they really have no idea how freakish they look to the rest of us? The thought of being left to my prep team's fashion whims only adds to the miseries competing for my attention. My abused body, my lack of sleep, my mandatory marriage, and the terror of being unable to satisfy President Snow's demands. By the time I reach lunch, where Effie, Cinna, Portia, Haymitch, and Peeta have started without me, I'm too weighed down to talk. They're raving about the food and how well they sleep on trains. Everyone's all full of excitement about the tour. Well, everyone but Haymitch. He's nursing a hangover and picking at a muffin. I'm not really hungry either, maybe because I loaded up on too much rich stuff this morning, or maybe because I'm so unhappy. I play around with a bowl of broth, eating only a spoonful or two. I can't even look at Peeta, my designated future husband, although I know none of this is his fault. People notice, try to bring me into the conversation, but I just brush them off. At some point, the train stops. Our server reports it will not just be for a fuel stop. Some part has malfunctioned and must be replaced. It will require at least an hour. This sends Effie into a state. She pulls out her schedule and begins to work out how the delay will impact every event for the rest of our lives. Finally, I just can't stand to listen to her anymore.
No one cares, Effie, I snap.
Everyone at the table stares at me, even Haymitch, who you'd think would be on my side in this matter since Effie drives him nuts. I'm immediately put on the defensive.
Well, no one does,
I say, and get up and leave the dining car. The train suddenly seems stifling, and I'm definitely queasy now. I find the exit door, force it open, triggering some sort of alarm, which I ignore, and jump to the ground, expecting to land in snow. But the air's warm and balmy against my skin. The trees still wear green leaves. How far south have we come in a day? I walk along the track, squinting against the bright sunlight, already regretting my words to Effie. She's hardly to blame for my current predicament. I should go back and apologize. My outburst was the height of bad manners, and manners matter deeply to her. But my feet continue on along the track, past the end of the train, leaving it behind. An hour's delay. I can walk at least 20 minutes in one direction and make it back with plenty of time to spare. Instead, after a couple hundred yards, I sink to the ground and sit there, looking into the distance. If I had a bow and arrows, would I just keep going? After a while, I hear footsteps behind me. It'll be Haymitch, coming to chew me out. It's not like I don't deserve it, but I still don't want to hear it. I'm not in a mood for a lecture. I warn the clump of weeds by my shoes. I'll try to keep it brief. Peeta takes a seat beside me. I thought you were Haymitch, I say.
No, he's still working on that muffin.
I watch as Peeta positions his artificial leg.
Bad day, huh?
It's nothing, I say. He takes a deep breath.
Look, Katniss, I've been wanting to talk to you about the way I acted on the train. I mean, the last train, the one that brought us home. I knew you had something with Gale. I was jealous of him before I even officially met you. And it wasn't fair to hold you to anything that happened in the games. I'm sorry.
His apology takes me by surprise. It's true that Peter froze me out after I confessed that my love for him during the games was something of an act. But I don't hold that against him. In the arena, I'd played that romance angle for all it was worth. There had been times when I didn't honestly know how I felt about him. I still don't, really. I'm sorry, too, I say. I'm not sure for what exactly. Maybe because there's a real chance I'm about to destroy him.
There's nothing for you to be sorry about. You were just keeping us alive. But I don't want us to go on like this, ignoring each other in real life and falling into the snow every time there's a camera around. So I thought if I stopped being so, you know, wounded, we could take a shot at just being friends, he says. All my friends are probably going to end up dead, but refusing Peter wouldn't keep him safe.
Okay,
I say. His offer does make me feel better, less duplicitous somehow. It would be nice if he'd come to me with this earlier, before I knew that President Snow had other plans, and just being friends was not an option for us anymore. But either way, I'm glad we're speaking again.
So what's wrong? He asks.
I can't tell him. I pick at the clump of weeds. Let's start with something more basic. Isn't it strange that I know you'd risk your life to save mine?
But I don't know what your favorite color is, he says.
A smile creeps onto my lips. Green. What's yours?
Orange, he says.
Orange? Like Effie's hair, I say.
A bit more muted, he says. More like sunset.
Sunset. I can see it immediately, the rim of the descending sun, the sky streaked with soft shades of orange. Beautiful. I remember the tiger lily cookie, and now that Peter is talking to me again, it's all I can do not to recount the whole story about President Snow.
But I know Haymitch wouldn't want me to.
I'd better stick to small talk.
You know, everyone's always raving about your paintings. I feel bad I haven't seen them, I say.
Well, I've got a whole train car full.
He rises and offers me his hand. Come on. It's good to feel his fingers entwined with mine again. Not for show, but in actual friendship. We walk back to the train hand in hand. At the door, I remember, I've got to apologize to Effie first.
Don't be afraid to lay it on thick, Peter tells me.
So when we go back to the dining car where the others are still at lunch, I give Effie an apology that I think is overkill, but in her mind probably just manages to compensate for my breach of etiquette. To her credit, Effie accepts graciously. She says it's clear I'm under a lot of pressure. And her comments about the necessity of someone attending to the schedule only last about 5 minutes. Really, I've gotten off easily. When Effie finishes, Peter leads me down a few cars to see his paintings. I don't know what I expected. Larger versions of the flower cookies, maybe. But this is something entirely different. Peter has painted the games. Some you wouldn't get right away if you hadn't been with him in the arena yourself. Water dripping through the cracks in our cave. The dry pond bed. A pair of hands, his own, digging for roots. Others any viewer would recognize. The golden horn called the cornucopia. Clove arranging the knives inside her jacket. One of the mutts, unmistakably the blonde, green-eyed one, meant to be Glimmer, snarling as it makes its way toward us. And me, I am everywhere, high up in a tree,
beating a shirt against the stones in the stream, lying unconscious in a pool of blood, and one I can't place. Perhaps this is how I looked when his fever was high, emerging from a silver-gray mist that matches my eyes exactly.
"What do you think?" he asks.
"I hate them," I say. I can almost smell the blood, the dirt, the unnatural breath of the mutt. "All I do is go around trying to forget the arena, and you've brought it back to life. How do you remember these things so exactly?"
"I see them every night," he says.
I know what he means. Nightmares, which I was no stranger to before the games, now plague me whenever I sleep. But the old standby, the one of my father being blown to bits in the mines, is rare. Instead, I relive versions of what happened in the arena. My worthless attempt to save Rue. Peeta bleeding to death. Glimmer's bloated body disintegrating in my hands. Cato's horrific end with the mutations. These are the most frequent visitors. Me too. Does it help? To paint them out?
I don't know. I think I'm a little less afraid of going to sleep at night. Or I tell myself I am, he says. But they haven't gone anywhere.
Maybe they won't. Haymitch's haven't.
Haymitch doesn't say so, but I'm sure this is why he doesn't like to sleep in the dark. No. But for me, it's better to wake up with a paintbrush than a knife in my hand, he says. So you really hate them?
Yes, but they're extraordinary. Really, I say. And they are. But I don't want to look at them any more. Want to see my talent? Cinna did a great job on it.
Peeta laughs. Later.
The train lurches forward, and I can see the land moving past us through the window.
Come on. We're almost to District 11. Let's go take a look at it.
We go down to the last car on the train. There are chairs and couches to sit on, but what's wonderful is that the back windows retract into the ceiling, so you're riding outside in the fresh air, and you can see a wide sweep of the landscape. Huge open fields with herds of dairy cattle grazing in them. So unlike our own heavily wooded home. We slow slightly, and I think we might be coming in for another stop when a fence rises up before us. Towering at least 35 feet in the air and topped with wicked coils of barbed wire, it makes ours back in District 12 look childish. My eyes quickly inspect the base, which is lined with enormous metal plates. There would be no burrowing under those, no escaping to hunt. Then I see the watchtowers, placed evenly apart, manned with armed guards, so out of place among the fields of wildflowers around them.
That's something different, says Peeta.
Rue did give me the impression that the rules in District 11 were more harshly enforced. But I never imagined something like this. Now the crops begin, stretched out as far as the eye can see. Men, women, and children wearing straw hats to keep off the sun straighten up, turn our way, take a moment to stretch their backs as they watch our train go by. I can see orchards in the distance, and I wonder if that's where Rue would have worked, collecting the fruit from the slimmest branches at the tops of the trees. Small communities of shacks, by comparison the houses in the seam are upscale, spring up here and there, but they're all deserted. Every hand must be needed for the harvest. On and on it goes. I can't believe the size of District 11.
How many people do you think live here? Peeta asks.
I shake my head. In school, they refer to it as a large district, that's all. No actual figures on the population. But those kids we see on camera waiting for the reaping each year, they can't be but a sampling of the ones who actually live here. What do they do? Have preliminary drawings?
pick the winners ahead of time and make sure they're in the crowd? How exactly did Rue end up on that stage, with nothing but the wind offering to take her place? I begin to weary of the vastness, the endlessness of this place. When Effie comes to tell us to dress, I don't object. I go to my compartment and let the prep team do my hair and makeup. Cinna comes in with a pretty orange frock patterned with autumn leaves. I think how much Peeta will like the color. Effie gets Peeta and me together and goes through the day's program one last time. In some districts, the victors ride through the city while the residents cheer. But in 11, maybe because there's not much of a city to begin with, things being so spread out, or maybe because they don't want to waste so many people while the harvest is on, the public appearance is confined to the square. It takes place before their justice building, a huge marble structure. Once it must have been a thing of beauty, but time has taken its toll. Even on television you can see ivy overtaking the crumbling facade, the sag of the roof. The square itself is ringed with run-down storefronts, most of which are abandoned. Wherever the well-to-do live in District 11, it's not here. Our entire public performance will be staged outside on what Effie refers to as the veranda, the tiled expanse between the front doors and the stairs that's shaded by a roof supported by columns. Peeta and I will be introduced. The mayor of 11 will read a speech in our honor and will respond with a scripted thank you provided by the Capitol. If a victor had any special allies among the dead tributes, it is considered good form to add a few personal comments as well. I should say something about Rue and Thresh, too, really, but every time I tried to write it at home, I ended up with a blank paper staring me in the face. It's hard for me to talk about them without getting emotional. Fortunately, Peeta has a little something worked up, and with some slight alterations, it can count for both of us. At the end of the ceremony, we'll be presented with some sort of plaque, and then we can withdraw to the Justice Building, where a special dinner will be served. As the train is pulling into the District 11 station, Cinna puts the finishing touches on my outfit, switching my orange hairband for one of metallic gold and securing the Mockingjay pin I wore in the arena to my dress. There's no welcoming committee on the platform, just a squad of 8 peacekeepers who direct us into the back of an armored truck. Effie sniffs as the door clanks closed behind us.
"Really? You'd think we were all criminals," she says.
"Not all of us, Effie. Just me, I think."
The truck lets us out at the back of the Justice Building. We're hurried inside. I can smell an excellent meal being prepared, but it doesn't block out the odors of mildew and rot. They've left us no time to look around. As we make a beeline for the front entrance, I can hear the anthem beginning outside in the square. Someone clips a microphone on me. Peeta takes my left hand. The mayor's introducing us as the massive doors open with a groan.
"Big smiles," Effie says, and gives us a nudge.
Our feet start moving forward. This is it. This is where I have to convince everybody how in love I am with Peeta, I think. The solemn ceremony is pretty tightly mapped out, so I'm not sure how to do it. It's not a time for kissing, but maybe I can work one in. There's loud applause, but none of the other responses we got in the Capitol, the cheers and whoops and whistles. We walk across the shaded veranda until the roof runs out, and we're standing at the top of a big flight of marble stairs in the glaring sun. As my eyes adjust, I see the buildings on the square have been hung with banners that help cover up their neglected state. It's packed with people, but again, just a fraction of the number who live here. As usual, a special platform has been constructed at the bottom of the stage for the families of the dead tributes. On Thresh's side, there's only an old woman with a hunched back and a tall, muscular girl, I'm guessing is his sister. On Rue's,
I'm not prepared for Rue's family. Her parents, whose faces are still fresh with sorrow. Her 5 younger siblings, who resemble her so closely. The slight builds, the luminous brown eyes, they form a flock of small, dark birds. The applause dies out, and the mayor gives the speech in our honor. 2 little girls come up with tremendous bouquets of flowers. Peter does his part of the scripted reply, and then I find my lips moving to conclude it. Fortunately, my mother and Prim have drilled me, so I can do it in my sleep. Peter had his personal comments written on a card, but he doesn't pull it out. Instead, he speaks in his simple, winning style about Thresh and Rue making it to the final 8, about how they both kept me alive, thereby keeping him alive, and about how this is a debt we can never repay. And then he hesitates before adding something that wasn't written on the card, maybe because he thought Effie might make him remove it. It can in no way replace your losses, but as a token of our thanks, we'd like for each of the tribute's families from District 11 to receive 1 month of our winnings every year for the duration of our lives. The crowd can't help but respond with gasps and murmurs. There is no precedent for what Peter has done. I don't even know if it's legal. He probably doesn't know either, so he didn't ask in case it isn't. As for the families, they just stare at us in shock. Their lives were changed forever when Thresh and Rue were lost, but this gift will change them again. A month of tribute winnings can easily provide for a family for a year. As long as we live, they will not hunger. I look at Peter, and he gives me a sad smile. I hear Hamish's voice.
You could do a lot worse.
At this moment, it's impossible to imagine how I could do any better. The gift, it is perfect. So when I rise up on tiptoe to kiss him, it doesn't seem forced at all. The mayor steps forward and presents us each with a plaque that's so large I have to put down my bouquet to hold it. The ceremony's about to end when I notice one of Rue's sisters staring at me. She must be about 9 and is almost an exact replica of Rue, down to the way she stands with her arms slightly extended. Despite the good news about the winnings, she's not happy. In fact, her look is reproachful. Is it because I didn't save Rue? No. It's because I still haven't thanked her, I think. A wave of shame rushes through me. The girl is right. How can I stand here, passive and mute, leaving all the words to Peter? If she had won, Rue would never have let my death go unsung. I remember how I took care in the arena to cover her with flowers, to make sure her loss did not go unnoticed, but that gesture will mean nothing if I don't support it now. Wait! I stumble forward, pressing the plaque to my chest. My allotted time for speaking has come and gone, but I must say something. I owe too much. And even if I had pledged all my winnings to the families, it would not excuse my silence today. Wait! Please! I don't know how to start, but once I do, the words rush from my lips as if they've been forming in the back of my mind for a long time. I want to give my thanks to the tributes of District 11, I say. I look at the pair of women on Thresh's side. I only ever spoke to Thresh 1 time, just long enough for him to spare my life. I didn't know him, but I always respected him for his power, for his refusal to play the games on anyone's terms but his own. The careers wanted him to team up with them from the beginning, but he wouldn't do it. I respected him for that. For the first time, the old hunched woman, is she Thresh's grandmother? Raises her head, and the trace of a smile plays on her lips. The crowd has fallen silent now,
so silent that I wonder how they manage it. They must all be holding their breath. I turn to Rue's family, but I feel as if I did know Rue, and she'll always be with me. Everything beautiful brings her to mind. I see her in the yellow flowers that grow in the meadow by my house. I see her in the mocking jays that sing in the trees. But most of all, I see her in my sister, Prim. My voice is undependable, but I am almost finished. Thank you for your children. I raise my chin to address the crowd. And thank you all for the bread. I stand there, feeling broken and small, thousands of eyes trained on me. There's a long pause. Then, from somewhere in the crowd, someone whistles Rue's four-note Mockingjay tune, the one that signaled the end of the workday in the orchards, the one that meant safety in the arena. By the end of the tune, I have found the whistler, a wizened old man in a faded red shirt and overalls. His eyes meet mine. What happens next is not an accident. It is too well executed to be spontaneous, because it happens in complete unison. Every person in the crowd presses the three middle fingers of their left hand against their lips and extends them to me. It's our sign from District 12, the last goodbye I gave Rue in the arena. If I hadn't spoken to President Snow, this gesture might move me to tears. But with his recent orders to calm the districts fresh in my ears, it fills me with dread. What will he think of this very public salute to the girl who defied the Capitol? The full impact of what I've done hits me. It was not intentional. I only meant to express my thanks, but I have elicited something dangerous. An act of dissent from the people of District 11. This is exactly the kind of thing I am supposed to be diffusing. I try to think of something to say to undermine what has just happened, to negate it, but I can hear the slight burst of static indicating my microphone has been cut off and the mayor has taken over. Peter and I acknowledge a final round of applause. He leads me back toward the doors, unaware that anything has gone wrong. I feel funny and have to stop for a moment. Little bits of bright sunshine dance before my eyes.
"Are you all right?" Peter asks.
"Just dizzy. The sun was so bright," I say. I see his bouquet. "I forgot my flowers," I mumble.
"I'll get them," he says.
"I can," I answer. We would be safe inside the Justice Building by now if I hadn't stopped, if I hadn't left my flowers. Instead, from the deep shade of the veranda, we see the whole thing. A pair of peacekeepers dragging the old man who whistled to the top of the steps, forcing him to his knees before the crowd, and putting a bullet through his head. Chapter 5. The man has only just crumpled to the ground when a wall of white peacekeeper uniforms blocks our view. Several of the soldiers have automatic weapons held lengthwise as they push us back toward the door.
"We're going," says Peeta, shoving the peacekeeper who's pressing on me. "We get it, all right? Come on, Katniss."
His arm encircles me and guides me back into the Justice Building. The peacekeepers follow a pace or two behind us. The moment we're inside, the doors slam shut, and we hear the peacekeepers' boots moving back toward the crowd. Hamish, Effie, Portia, and Cinna wait under a static-filled screen that's mounted on the wall, their faces tight with anxiety.
"What happened?" Effie hurries over. "We lost the feed just after Katniss's beautiful speech, and then Hamish said he thought he heard a gunfire, and I said it was ridiculous, but who knows? There are lunatics everywhere."
"Nothing happened, Effie,"
An old truck backfired, says Peter evenly. Two more shots. The door doesn't muffle their sound much. Who was that? Thresh's grandmother? One of Rue's little sisters?
Both of you, with me, says Haymitch.
Peter and I follow him, leaving the others behind. The peacekeepers who are stationed around the justice building take little interest in our movements now that we are safely inside. We ascend a magnificent curved marble staircase. At the top, there's a long hall with worn carpet on the floor. Double doors stand open, welcoming us into the first room we encounter. The ceiling must be 20 feet high. Designs of fruit and flowers are carved into the molding, and small, fat children with wings look down at us from every angle. Vases of blossoms give off a cloying scent that makes my eyes itch. Our evening clothes hang on racks against the wall. This room has been prepared for our use, but we're barely there long enough to drop off our gifts. Then Haymitch yanks the microphones from our chests, stuffs them beneath a couch cushion, and waves us on. As far as I know, Haymitch has only been here once, when he was on his victory tour decades ago. But he must have a remarkable memory or reliable instincts, because he leads us up through a maze of twisting staircases and increasingly narrow halls. At times he has to stop and force a door. By the protesting squeak of the hinges, you can tell it's been a long time since it was opened. Eventually, we climb a ladder to a trap door. When Haymitch pushes it aside, we find ourselves in the dome of the justice building. It's a huge place filled with broken furniture, piles of books and ledgers, and rusty weapons. The coat of dust blanketing everything is so thick it's clear it hasn't been disturbed for years. Light struggles to filter in through four grimy square windows set in the sides of the dome. Haymitch kicks the trapdoor shut and turns on us.
"What happened?" he asks.
Peter relates all that occurred in the square. The whistle, the salute, our hesitation on the veranda, the murder of the old man.
"What's going on, Haymitch?" "It'll be better coming from you," Haymitch says to me.
I don't agree. I think it will be 100 times worse coming from me. But I tell Peter everything as calmly as I can. About President Snow, the unrest in the districts. I don't even omit the kiss with Gale. I lay out how we are all in jeopardy, how the whole country is in jeopardy because of my trick with the berries. I was supposed to fix things on this tour, make everyone who had doubted believe I acted out of love, calm things down. But obviously, all I've done today is get 3 people killed, and now everyone in the square will be punished. I feel so sick that I have to sit down on a couch, despite the exposed springs and stuffing.
Then I made things worse, too, by giving them money, says Peter.
Suddenly he strikes out at a lamp that sits precariously on a crate and knocks it across the room, where it shatters against the floor.
This has to stop, right now. This game you two play, where you tell each other secrets but keep them from me like I'm too inconsequential or stupid or weak to handle them.
It's not like that, Peter, I begin.
It's exactly like that, he yells at me. I have people I care about too, Katniss, family and friends back in District 12 who will be just as dead as yours if we don't pull this thing off. So after all we went through in the arena, don't I even rate the truth from you?
You're always so reliably good, Peter, says Haymitch. So smart about how you present yourself before the cameras. I didn't want to disrupt that.
Well, you overestimated me, because I really screwed up today. What do you think is going to happen to Rue's and Thresh's families? Do you think they'll get their share of our winnings? Do you think I gave them a bright future? Because I think they'll be lucky if they survive the day.
Peter sends something else flying, a statue. I've never seen him like this. He's right, Haymitch, I say. We were wrong not to tell him, even back in the capital, Even in the arena, you two had some sort of system worked out, didn't you? Asks Peeta. His voice is quieter now. Something I wasn't part of.
No, not officially. I just could tell what Haymitch wanted me to do by what he sent or didn't send, I say.
Well, I never had that opportunity.